The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I saddle up with one half of the Coen brothers' directorial team. Ethan Coen tells me what inspired them to reinvent the classic Western, True Grit. And The Guardian's Francesca Panetta reports from the Rotterdam Film Festival on Cinema Reloaded, a new scheme to get cash to young filmmakers and to make a movie producer of all of us. Zan Brooks will be along as we review some of the week's other releases, including Keira Knightley and Kerry Mulligan in Never Let Me Go, Gnomeo and Juliet, the tale of two star-crossed gnomes, and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost reunite for the alien comedy, Paul. Yes, it's a close encounter of the movie kind. It's Film Weekly. After last week's reversioning of Brighton Rock, it's starting to become a trend in cinema that directors return to the original novel on which classic films are based and breathe new life into them. This week, the Coen brothers have done just that with the release of their version of True Grit. True Grit was originally a novel by Richard Portis, which was first filmed by Henry Hathaway and starring John Wayne as the deadly marshal Rooster Coben. The Coens have returned to the original text, replacing John Wayne with Jeff Bridges, who plays the wild Coben, hired by a 14-year-old girl to track down and punish the man who murdered her father. I met up with Ethan Coen to discuss him and his brother Joel's attraction to the story of True Grit and the Western genre in general. But first, let's hear the Oscar nominees Jeff Bridges and Hailee Steinfeld in action.
They tell me you're a man with true grit.
What do you want, girl? Speak up at supper time.
I'm looking for the man who shot and killed my father, Frank Ross, in front of the Monarch boarding house. The man's name is Tom Chaney. They say he's over in Indian territory, and I need somebody to go after him. There is a fugitive warrant out for Chaney. Government will pay you $2 for bringing him in, plus 10 cents a mile for each of you. On top of that, I will pay you a $50 reward.
What are you?
Nobody here knew my father, and I'm afraid nothing is going to be done about Chaney except I do it. My brother is a child, and my mother is indecisive and hobbled by grief.
I don't believe you have $50.
I have a contract with Colonel Stonehill, which he will make payment on tomorrow or the next day, once a lawyer countersigns.
Don't believe in fairy tales or sermons or stories about money, baby sister, but thanks for the cigarette.
Congratulations on True Grit.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. In fact, immensely enjoyed it. Because it was, you know, you don't see enough horses and campfires these days.
Good to see the horses, isn't it? Horses are strange creatures. I mean, wow, they're powerful animals with strange, unpredictable little pea brains.
Because you had a great dog on No Country for Old Men. I remember you telling me about him, Scooby.
Yeah.
Wonderful dog. And so
tell you about Scooby. Yeah.
Scooby was great. Right. But now you've really kind of upped the ante now in your animal wrangling.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, we were actually entered this with a lot of trepidation about working with horses, having talked with the few people working in Hollywood now who still have experience working with horses. That was the one production worry that we had that ended up being pretty pleasant. We had a great wrangler, a guy named Rusty Hendrickson, and the horses he works with, the trainers he works with, that all actually went well.
That's such a Coen brothers name, Rusty Hendricks. I mean, you could have made him up.
Yeah, no, Rusty. Rusty is too pleasant and even tempered for us to have made. Now, the horses were fun, actually, as it turned out. Everything else, primarily weather, worked against us, but the horses were with us.
Mm-hmm. When you watch Westerns growing up as a kid, I don't know if they're part of your lexicon, but as a filmmaker, I assume that, you know, that, and as an American, that they must be pretty much ingrained in there as a mythology. Was it always something you wanted to tackle?
Yeah, I guess we were maybe in the back of our minds interested in doing a Western, but, you know, we saw this one not so much as a genre exercise. We didn't latch onto it as an opportunity to do a Western, in quotes, as so much as we just did it out of an enthusiasm for the novel, which is not, again, in quotes, not a genre Western. It's not a Zane Grey Western. It is a movie. It's a story that takes place in Arkansas and the Oklahoma Territory in the 1870s. So it's and it does have people on horses, and it does have six guns. So the audience is going to see it as a Western, and who am I to argue? But it's not, as I say, it wasn't a genre novel, and I hope it's not just a genre movie.
Mm. Well, in fact, what's funny about it is that it's not that genre movie. You know, if it was a Western, you might have expected the Coens to kind of Blazing Saddles it up a bit. There isn't that kind of deflation of the genre.
Right. There isn't comment on the genre because, as you say, it isn't exactly a genre exercise. And if it were, it probably would not have a 14-year-old girl as the central character.
Mm. Is that what appeals? Because, I mean, in the original movie, I didn't know she was 14 because Kim never looked. She didn't look 14 to me. But no one ever did back then, anyway.
Yeah, no, I know. It was probably it's a Hollywood tradition convention that you can cast about a decade older than the character actually is supposed to be. But that is the charm of the book, is that it's told in the voice of a 14-year-old girl, and that's something you certainly want to. Well, I say certainly they didn't in the original movie. It's something we wanted to preserve.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that when listening to it, that's what attracted you, that narration, that kind of brilliant floridity of the words that she has, the wonderful sentences that come from the precocity of this child, but also the kind of directness, the rat-a-tat of her kind of intellect.
Yeah, it's a combination of actor and part. Haley can really spit it out and really make it her own. But all of the characters speak in a way that's florid and certainly formal sounding to contemporary ears. There is something about the dialogue that's actually, again, kind of funny in the mouths of some of these characters. She's certainly somebody who's read the Bible, one assumes, but a lot of these characters you assume would be illiterate, and they're equally well-spoken, actually.
Yeah. You know anything about the whereabouts of Cheney?
Oh, he's in the territory, and I hold out little hope for you winning your bounty.
Why is that?
My man will beat you to it. I've hired a deputy marshal, the toughest one they have.
Well, I will throw in with you and your marshal.
No. Marshal Cogburn and I are fine.
It'll be to our mutual advantage.
When Cheney is taken, he's coming back to Fort Smith to hang. I'm not having him go to Texas to hang for shooting some senator.
It is not important where he hangs, is it?
It is to me. Is it to you?
It means a great deal of money to me. It's been many months' work.
Oh, I'm sorry that you were paid piecework and not on wages, and that you have been eluded the winter long by a half-wit.
You give out very little sugar with your pronouncements. While I sat there watching you, I gave some thought to stealing a kiss, though you are very young and sick and unattractive to boot. But now I have a mind to give you 5 or 6 good licks with my belt.
One would be as unpleasant as the other.
Is that the challenge for a writing point of view, to kind of get inside that head? Because it isn't like when you're doing a serious man, you just have to kind of remember what was like growing up for you. But to do a kind of, I don't know, an intellect and a character that's suffused with, I suppose, stuff that isn't around anymore.
That's the fun of the exercise, right? It's a character whose whole outlook is informed by King James Bible, probably more than anything else. But not that we have to get into that head to write it, in as much as most of the dialogue is taken straight from the book. There is a bit that we have a couple of scenes that don't derive from the novel where we had to kind of ape that style. But that was kind of, that's interesting as a writing task.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of reminded me in a way of the Jennifer Jason Leigh character in Hudsucker Proxy. That's kind of the closest that I could see in your work. Of course, there are many great female characters who have great dialogue, but it was the pace and the wit of the dialogue that seemed to kind of...
Right. That was stylized in a different way. Or I say stylized, that was stylized. I think that the Portis novel is authentic, or it sounds authentic. Mm-hmm. But yes, there again, it's kind of to artificial ears, a very to contemporary ears, a very artificial mode of speech. But that's it's
artificial ears would be good.
Artificial ears.
You've been doing this a long time. When you came to London for A Serious Man, a film which I loved very much, in fact you berated me for loving it too much.
Did I?
Yes, you said I needed to get a life, probably. But then I questioned the wisdom of two Jewish boys going into the Western territory and what the two nice Jewish boys would be doing on horseback. But you obviously clearly managed it. Jews in Western.
Something funny. Tom Hanks was laughing on the set of The Lady Killers about, he characterized us as a couple of yeshiva boys who'd enlisted their goy friend Roger Deakins into going and going off and making a movie in the Deep South. Yeah, there's something wrong with it, isn't there?
So Deakins again was your kind of, you know, your
our Gentile friend, yes.
Exactly. Leading you through hostile Indian country.
Yeah, that's his, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, he deserves an Oscar in the end.
For putting up with us, nothing else.
Exactly. Where is Joel? Do you miss Joel? I miss him. I'm not saying this is not going well. This is lovely, but where is Joel?
Yeah, we're managing to have fun without him. He's doing this in Paris at this very moment because, oh my God, you don't want to know about our schedule. It's ridiculous and pointless and We have to. It's a good thing there are two of us at this point to cover the bases.
You can cover more than you should win more Oscars than anyone else because you can cover more bases than Fincher. He can only just be in one place. Although he does CGI with faces, so he could be in any place.
No comment.
Just before you go, I know you've written Gambit, which is a film I absolutely love, and you've rewritten that. You've rewritten the original script for that one.
Yes. Yeah. It's an interesting movie, wasn't it? The kind of central conceit was kind of great. So we were hired to write that as a writing job. We're not making the movie, but it's a script that we wrote for...
And you okay with that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. Look forward to seeing the movie.
Okay. Well, I do too. But for now, I shall content myself with True Grit, which is superb. Rare moments these days, and I'm just going, oh, this is great. I'm really enjoying myself. I put down my pen, stop taking notes. Then I get to the end and go, God, I've got nothing to ask Ethan about. But I do enjoy it immensely. So really nice to see it again through your eyes, Ethan Cohen. And do send our regards to Joel when you finally meet up with him and the two of you are replete.
I will. And I'm pleased to have made you put down your pen.
True Grit goes on nationwide release here in the UK from Friday the 11th of February. And riding in from the west, it's that cowboy, that lonesome dove, Zan Brooks, here to join me to talk about the week's releases. We must start with the Coen brothers' True Grit. 10 Oscar nominations, 115 BAFTA nominations. They're the establishment now, the Coens.
They're the outsiders turned insiders, aren't they? And that's very heartening to see.
Is it? Because I mean, we've liked them for years,
yeah.
Obviously. But
and now the world likes them.
Now
too.
Everyone likes them.
Yeah.
And True Grit has been a huge success as well commercially.
It's been an amazing success. It's sort of is the rebirth of the Western,
yeah,
supposedly
again.
and it's very much a Western. They aren't dicking around with the formula. I mean, with the Coen brothers, we expect that some sort of subversive element.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be any of that in this. It's very much by the book. And that is good and bad. It's good in that you get a very, very satisfying Western. It's the real American archetypes all there in place, and the sense of civilization clinging onto the wilderness.
Yeah.
And when they go across the river and into the trees, you know that the old rules don't apply anymore. And all of that is very reassuring as drama. At the same time, I was wanting something, some deviation from that path.
I thought they might do it. If they're doing a Western, I thought there'd be some kind of genre jokes or sly asides. And there aren't really. I mean, what you get, though, is very lovely dialogue. I mean, particularly delivered by Hayley Steinfeld as the kind of young, loquacious 14-year-old who has some great lines in it, which I presume come from the novel. I haven't read the original novel.
Yes, Charles Portis.
And so you get that, and there's wit there, and that I can see that's attracted the Coen brothers to the floridity and the wit of her dialogue.
Yeah, and that's sort of that weird Western poetry that Ethan Coen is obviously very drawn to and has great fun in sculpting and making these characters kind of enunciate and these kind of strange swirling ways of speaking. All of that is good. It is well acted. Everybody is saying how great Hayley Steinfeld was. I found her the role a bit one note. She's the feisty angel of vengeance.
Oh, I liked it for about an hour, and then
exactly.
I was like,
and you think that now what else? I actually thought Matt Damon was the best thing.
He was
in
really
this,
good, yeah.
As the Texas Ranger, and that he's the only one who can go either way. That he's totally vain and ridiculous, but he's also admirable as well. And you're not quite sure where he's going in this.
I really enjoyed True Grit. I thought, oh, good, this is a good film, and I'm really enjoying it. When it finished, I thought, I'm just very surprised that it's kind of, the second favourite in the Oscars race. What does it mean?
What does it mean? It means that the Academy loves the Coen brothers, I think, and they particularly love them when they play it straight. This isn't A Serious Man, which was odd.
Yeah.
This is more like... No Country for Old Men, in that it's a hard, lean, neat piece of carpentry. I thought No Country for Old Men was a great film. I don't think this is.
I don't think it is either,
but
I really enjoyed it.
Perfectly satisfying.
Really enjoyed it. True Grit by Joel and Ethan Coen. Should we go to another tale of the American West, which has English people in it? It's got Simon Pegg and Nick Frost as Paul. They are two nerds going to Comic Con, and then they make a trek across America to go to alien hotspots. And would you know it, they bump into Paul.
You guys partake?
No, thank you.
I'll partake.
Are you sure? It's pretty strong shit. I get it from the military, actually. This is the stuff that killed Dylan.
Bob Dylan's not dead.
Isn't he?
Hit me.
Okay, just, go easy on it.
Ruth.
A little bit.
It's not so bad.
I think, yeah. To be fair, it takes a while to be absorbed in.
I'm hungry. We should cook up some sausages. Do we have any sausages? What do you mean by that? No. Why do you guys hate me? Can we cook up some sausages?
Loving the alien there, Seth Rogen, the voice of Paul, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, our lovable English duo. Is this Shaun of the Dead meets E.T.?
I think that's probably what they're trying for, isn't it? What it's more like is being forced to look through somebody's holiday slides and have them tell you what a hilarious time they had when they were driving across America.
Do you like Pegg and Frost?
I did. I did, but I think the thing with Pegg and Frost is that their USP is that they're kind of one of us. You know, they're the guys that we can relate to. And this felt like them going, you know, haha, we've now got to America. We've got to make an American film and hang out with Steven Spielberg. So screw you, you losers. And then so suddenly they're not as funny anymore when they're doing that.
I found it a not unlikable film. I sort of amiable yet aimless as well. I didn't know where it was going or why
it's
it was going anywhere.
Wildly self-indulgent, isn't it?
I mean, it was about them. It climaxes with them being kind of fated at Comic-Con.
Yes.
Which is surely what happens to Nick Pegg and Simon Frost when they go to Comic-Con.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems like, well, why is that in your movie?
Well, it's total solipsism, isn't it? And I suppose we're expected to sort of celebrate the rise of these two nerds.
But given that we had some sort of ownership on them because they were kind of, you know, they used to do Channel 4 things and we watched them at 11 o'clock on a Friday night and then they did Shaun of the Dead and they lived in Crouch End and that was all great and all local. Now that they are going to make a big movie, a proper movie that American people might actually go and see, we don't have ownership on them anymore. So we can't feel jealous that old Simon and Nick have gone off.
Not at all. I just wish that they were making better movies over there. This felt a bit like, remember that Danny Boyle misfire, A Life Less Ordinary, which was very much the successful Brits getting to make an American film and very much a sort of tourist view of American pop culture. And there's no real insight. And maybe you don't want insight from a film about bloody aliens, but you want some kind of sharpness and some rigour. And this just felt a little bit like they were kind of yucking it up for their own benefit.
Didn't you think that at least it was sort of decently written, that all things came to you know, it was kind of polished in a way. I noticed it was a working title movie, and working title who used to do this stuff with rom-coms and then went off and try and make auteur-based movies and decided that was no good at all. Seemed to be going back to the kind of quite polished script. I mean, you know, something happens in the beginning and then it kind of pops up again in the middle and then it gets resolved by the end. All of that seems to be in place here. I just didn't really feel anything for it.
Yeah, I think it was that. But surely, again, as with the Coen brothers, you expect something more. You expect actually something a bit more ramshackle from Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Something a bit more homespun and eccentric. And this felt bland.
Yeah, it wasn't very funny.
It wasn't funny at all.
It's supposed to be funny. Seth Rogen as the stoned alien.
Yeah, I know. I was wanting to laugh very much because I do like them and I do think Shaun of the Dead is one of the great British films of the last 10 years.
Every time I see another one of their films, I just think, blimey hell, Shaun of the Dead was bloody good though, wasn't it?
And I watched it again quite recently and it stood up. This, I don't think I will be revisiting.
No, I think you're right, in this galaxy or any other. For our next film, we'll stay with a largely British cast as Keira Knightley, Kerry Mulligan and Andrew Garfield have to leave school and make their way in the big bad world of England.
Ruth, why do you do that thing? Squeezing Tommy's shoulder.
I'm allowed to touch Tommy, aren't I?
It's the way you're touching him. You know what I mean, it's copied from that television show.
That's so not...
Don't tell me that's so not true. All that behaviour, that's not what people do out there in real life, if that's what you were thinking.
So what? It's no big deal. A lot of us do it.
What you mean is Chrissy and Rod do it?
Oh, Kathy. Must be really awful for you, surrounded by all these couples.
I never said that. I just think it's daft. You copy them and they copy from a television show.
I'm right, aren't I? You don't like the fact that Tommy and I are friends with Chrissy and Rod, whereas you hardly speak to anyone.
No, you're not.
Never Let Me Go is the title of the film, based on a book by Kazuo Ishiguro, directed by Mark Romanek. It opened the London Film Festival, where we talked about it there, but now it's out and about. And I think, given its release date, they were obviously hoping for kind of being included in the BAFTAs and the Oscars and all of that. That sadly seems to not have happened.
It's
for the
very
film.
Odd why that hasn't happened at all, it's particularly almost, at the BAFTAs.
It's almost like, no, you're not coming. I mean, it's almost a, I would call it
a Cinderella syndrome, isn't it? I can only imagine. I mean, Never Let Me Go, it's the sort of bright star effect, isn't it? Like, it opened in Toronto and people were hailing it as a masterpiece. And then there was a backlash, and then I think it opened in America and didn't do very well at all.
No.
And BAFTA have now kind of just backed away from it, like a sort of a dirty relation that they kind of want to disown.
They really don't. I mean, they sort of kind of, which I think is a bit harsh, no?
Well, why not Never Let Me Go, but why The King's Speech? You'd think that both films are what BAFTA voters would love. Mm. It's a very plush, refined, well-made drama.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I liked it.
I preferred it to The King's Speech.
Me too. So what? I mean, they don't like Keira Knightley anyway. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like Keira Knightley at all. Right. I think she's actually rather good in this film.
She is good in this.
And I thought everyone was quite good.
Everyone
in this
was good. Andrew Garfield was great.
Really
in it.
Good.
And Kerry Mulligan in a very difficult role as the sort of narrator who's the kind of the observer who has to hold it together. It's like Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. You know, it's the toughest role that you've got in a film.
It is a strange film. I'll give it that, because it is based on this book, but it has this sort of big reveal in it that was like, well, which I'm not going to do here. But
are you not? Like, even though the reveal comes about 20 minutes into the film.
And everyone knows about it. Yeah. Okay, should we do it?
Do it. You do it. You take the bullet.
They're clones.
Okay.
There you go. That was, you could look away
now. They're brought up in a kind of cloistered boarding school that's actually a farm for human organs, and they have a sort of finite lifespan, these people, and are seen very much as second-class citizens. And so it's a love triangle drama between the three of them. And it's played out very evocatively in this very sort of downbeat, tatty, exhausted Britain of faded seaside resorts and hospital wards. And all of that is very well done. It probably is... You know, if there's a fault that people won't go and see this film, it is gloomy. It is a minor key dying fall of a film.
Well, it's about dying and it's about the power of the heart. But it is about the power of the heart and the power of love and the true nature of love and all of that. All of these things are good things, I think.
All these things are good. And I think that there's a real soul to this film and definitely a sadness there.
But it is a mood movie. It's not sad because, oh, here's Colin Firth going overcoming his disability and here's the triumphal moment. It is very much suggested. You know, people say, well, why? There's a very bit where they sort of check in and check out of their little huts because they can't go on the loose. And they have that, perhaps the little tags in there. No, it's never made explicit. Like, people say to me, well, why don't they run away? And I said, because they don't. You don't run away. Why don't you go and live in America? Why don't you go and, you know, because you don't.
Exactly, and that's the point of the film. But it's a marketing person's nightmare, isn't it, this film? Because it's basically a dystopian sci-fi thriller, and yet there's no thrills in there. It's not like Logan's Run, where they kind of break out. They're prisoners, and the implication is that we're all kind of prisoners.
Well, this is it. This seems to me that we're all prisoners of a system, and a very English system. And Ishiguro often does this kind of like button-down Englishness that he did in Remains of the Day, and it runs all the way through his books. People say, well, they went to boarding school. They went to this school, and you don't walk on the grass at school. I still walk around grass because I went to a school where you weren't, for no reason. There was a lovely bit of grass. We couldn't walk on it, and I still prefer to walk on a pavement.
Yeah.
We don't. That's the point of the film. And people say, well, it's just very stupid, isn't it? I say, well, it may be, but that's the point of it. And if you don't like it, don't go. And they haven't.
They haven't, but I think they probably should.
Yes. Changing tack, but staying in Britain again, Elton John and David Furnish have finally made a movie together. It's called Gnomeo and Juliet. It's about red gnomes and blue gnomes across the fence.
You're probably wondering what I'm doing on the roof of your greenhouse. It's just I thought no one lived here.
They don't. I mean, I don't. This isn't my garden.
Oh, well, that's good, because I just came to get that orchid.
Oh, this?
Yes.
I don't know. I think I'm going to have to keep a hold of this one.
What? But I saw it first, so why don't you just hand it over?
Well, I grabbed it first. Possession is 9/10 of the law. What if you want it? Come and get it.
All right. Thanks.
Nice green hat, eh?
Oh, yeah, you should see it from here.
What, and miss this view? Who's your gnomie?
Who's your gnomie?
Whoa! Yeah, it's a little skit on Shakespeare. It's James McAvoy and Emily Blunt as gnomes who shouldn't be falling in love.
Yeah, I mean, this is what, you know, we've waited all this time for Elton John and David Furnish to put out a movie. And, you know, it's that thing that you don't know what you really want until you get it. And what you really want is Shakespeare played out with gardeners.
It's really weird, because when they got together, David Furnish, and he was like, oh, my film producer boyfriend. And you think, it's not going to be long. You know, why is David Furnish with Elton John? You know, what attracted you to billionaire rock star Elton John? And it was like, well, he keeps trying to make movies, and it's never really been that successful.
Well, he's finally realised the dream, hasn't
he? And Elton, you always thought, well, Elton's never going to... A bit like Elton when he's in charge of Watford, never gave him lots of money. Yeah. You know, that he's just like a little bit hands-off. Suddenly, he's given David, all right, David, you can have Crocodile Rock, you can have Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. And David's like, oh, really, really, I can
and
have it.
And what is he going to do with it?
You can do it with high-pitched gnome voices. How about that? Brilliant. Yes, you can have that. Given you a baby, now you can have Crocodile Rock. It seemed to be the only reason... The reason that the film sort of works is that there are Elton John songs in it.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? I'm wondering if this is the start of a franchise as well. Because there's a huge back catalogue of Elton to mine.
But yeah, we could have cartoons.
Or we could have, like, you know, Teddy Bear Othello, couldn't we?
That
or
would work.
A Monkey Midsummer Night's Dream.
Midsummer Night's Bream with fish.
That would be fantastic, yeah. Wouldn't it?
Spamlet, little Danish pigs.
This is going to run and run.
I fear it might, though. I'm giving them too many ideas. Little garden elf night you could have.
Elf night? Oh, you know.
I'm on fire.
Yeah, well, get on the phone.
That's it.
That said, you're going to slide this off
no,
now,
No, I'm not.
You?
Do you know what?
You're going to bite the hand that feeds you.
This is rubbish. I was watching it. And it sort of started running. About the time they did Don't Go Breaking My Heart montage, I thought, this is winning me over in the way that Don't Go Breaking My Heart sort of does, you know, relentlessly.
And obviously, we're going to spoil this for people who've never known nothing about Romeo and Juliet. But of course, it does build to a tragic suicide played out with garden gnomes.
Did you like it?
I didn't hate it.
Neither did I. That's the thing.
Yeah,
there's
a weird charm to it, and I thought Emily Blunt and James McAvoy were at least kind of having fun with it.
She's really good. I like
Ashley Jensen as the sort of frog ornament on the fountain.
Michael Caine and Judy Walters, Hulk Hogan was in there, and Elsie Osborne played a sort of Bambi thing.
Yeah, they're all there, and it's got Elton John songs, and it's basically, I think basically, it's Romeo and Juliet, but with gnomes.
And we didn't mind it. What's going on? Zan, I don't know what to say about that, really.
I don't know. Have we just given a better review to Romeo and Juliet than we did to True Grit?
I think we might have.
That's quite worrying.
I'm going to tell Ethan Cohen
that. We both need a holiday.
Zan, thank you very much. For all of Zan's musings on the world of film, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Hard to believe, but even the mighty Coen brothers still find it hard to get the money to make their films, so you can imagine how difficult it is for filmmakers starting out. With this in mind, the Rotterdam Film Festival has decided to run an innovative scheme to entice film fans to fund two film projects picked by the festival. This fan-funded scheme has been called Cinema Reloaded, and The Guardian's Francesca Panetta set off to the Netherlands to meet the man behind the idea, festival director Rutger Wolfson, and his chosen filmmakers Alexis Dos Santos and Ho Yuang, to find out if this could be how films get greenlit in the future.
I read this thing on the news about somebody who wanted to invade my country. So I had wanted to stage it with actors to begin with, because I thought that group would be very hard to contact. They are in Indonesia.
So this is a story about Indonesians trying to invade Malaysia.
Yes.
Diakui oleh Malaysia kayak batik, kayak lagu dulu rasa sayangnya gitu. Jadi itu kan
milik. Hello.
Is that your room?
Yeah.
I was writing for a project called Another World. It's about people who meet online and become close friends and stuff. So I got people from Rotterdam asking me if I had a short film project. And I was like, well, I could, you know, if I'm writing a novel and I'm making a feature, I may as well make it a short film.
I had a dream about you.
What was it like?
You were playing guitar.
We wanted very different directors, very different styles. We wanted an Asian director because we thought we might appeal to the Asian community. And Alexis Dos Santos was just a filmmaker that we also... They're both really close to us. We all really like them, so made sense.
So you made a big announcement at the festival last year asking for people to donate what? How much?
Well, the minimum was €5, but they could spend more if they wanted to.
And how much did they need? I mean, who came up with the budget for this?
We didn't know what to expect. We started out at €30,000 per project. And then somewhere in the project, we realized that was far too ambitious, so we lowered the budget to 15,000. But that was just sort of like us trying to figure out what would be a reasonable amount.
Who did you sponsor?
Alexis.
How much did you sponsor?
€25.
I supported each film with €25. So it's small money, but it's nice.
€50. €50, yeah. For me, I'm
don't earn a lot, so just a little bit. But I think it helped on him.
And how much interaction did you have with him? Like, during, did you follow him along the way? Did you email him? What was the, as a co-producer, what were you doing?
I followed him on the site. Yeah, like once a month I check the site, and I send in a video for the film, for the beginning of the film.
We needed 40 videos, and my producer was like, when she read the script, how are we gonna have like 60 secondary characters when we have only 15,000 euro? And I was like, well, we have a lot of producers, I'm sure we can do something with them.
The directors, I guess you had to have a dialogue with them saying, this is what we need you to do along the way. You can't just make the films, you have to interact with the people who are supporting you. Did it take a bit of a persuading?
Well, not really. I mean, as I said, they're both really close to the festival, so they sort of like said yes out of loyalty and also because I think they really liked the idea.
I had to interact with people.
How did you find that?
It was okay, you know. I didn't like it very much, but those people were very nice. So I didn't mind it, you know. I tried to limit myself as to, like, I didn't want my whole day to be just devoted to this audience, so I had to work.
The thing was, I didn't want to post the whole script because that's a bit like, you know, I don't know, just like feeling like exposing yourself naked on the web or something. I don't know, I just, you don't want to do that. So I was just like posting sometimes fragments of the story. I wasn't very good at it, actually. I have to confess, I was a bit of a lazy blogger. Contact my co-producers, but the post that I was sending, I had to push myself, and you have to be. I mean, if you want to actually raise money from people, you know, you have to constantly be there.
Have you been following them along the way? Have you been reading about what they've been doing?
In the beginning, but on the way I lost track.
Once in a month, I looked at what he had done and his remarks, and I emailed him a little bit. So sometimes he answered, sometimes not. But
so you had direct contact with him?
Yeah, sometimes.
Where are you from?
Buenos Aires. And you?
Berlin, Germany.
Oh, really? I want to go to Europe soon.
It's cold now, it's winter, but in the summer it's super.
Tell me, why did you call them co-producers?
Well, we had to find a name for how we would call them, and we wanted to stay away from very financial sounding names, because you know, at the time when we started thinking about this, wasn't a big financial crisis, so we didn't want to have any names that's associated with bankers or anything. And we came up with this.
For me, as a radio producer, that makes me terrified, the idea of 500 co-producers all having influence on my work. I would be, you know, I'd run a mile of that.
Well, we made it very clear that these are auteur filmmakers, so it's really up to them to make whatever they want. There's no audience input in terms of the script or editing or actors. There's none of that. So you shouldn't be afraid.
Would you have been able to be commissioned to make this film in any other way? Like, was it possible without this commission?
I think it's not so easy, because I think this idea itself is very dangerous. Like in Malaysia, people would think, why would you want to stir a shit? Why would you want to do something that it's potentially harmful to the relationship of these two countries? This was a very great opportunity when it came. I thought, you know, something like this, I shouldn't waste it. So I thought of doing something rather dangerous, something that was not possible if it's happening back home.
Why did you want to support them? Why give them your money?
Just because the festival said it's good.
You have faith in the festival because of the quality of the festival. If this project, Cinema Reloaded, wasn't linked to the film festival, Rotterdam Film Festival, would you support it?
No.
You didn't quite make your target, did you, the 15,000?
No, we didn't. But you have to look at what makes a project like this work. It might be different for filmmakers who don't have really an alternative. They might approach this project differently. So it could work there. But again, we are developing this, and we need a big partner. We will need like a big NGO to help us out.
I guess it brings the question, if you've got the whole Rotterdam Film Festival behind you, you roll out a crowdsourcing scheme, you still don't even manage to make 15,000. Is crowdfunding really the way forward for the film industry?
I think it's a way for doing certain things, and I don't know if it's like the way for people to go.
Is it something you'd consider doing yourself without the support of a festival behind you?
No, I would only do it again if I have someone, you know, like the reason why I went for it, it was because Rotterdam, they've been supportive to all my career from the beginning.
Yes, in fact, this could potentially be something very great, especially in my country, because, you know, in Southeast Asian countries, we need a lot of portals for free speech and for a lot of new way of expressing discontent. You know, I was thinking that, you know, maybe this could be a way for people to not just do, you know, very personal stuff, but also something that connects to the society, something that is about the current issues.
Have you got any idea what to expect tonight?
I haven't the foggiest what's coming up to now.
Are you excited about what you're going to see?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
This had to be built from the bottom up. I just want to quickly remind you of the reasons why this happened. I think so. There's three motivations that are really important. The first is that the passion that Rotterdam and you have for art film, stretching the line, it's been a while. I need a good bedtime.
Would you wait a while before you change your mind?
So can I ask you, what did you think of it? Was it worth the money?
The first one, I thought it was more a documentary. And the second, I liked it. Yeah.
The one that yes. You paid money for, you liked.
Yeah, I liked it, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was great. Yeah, it was terrific, yeah.
Worth the 25 euros?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Finally, facing your co-producers, the people who funded you at the end of the evening, standing up there looking them in the face, how was that?
I don't know, it's just nice to see that actually they like the film.
I thought the screening turned out very well, and I actually saw this film myself the first time on big screen, because when I was editing, it's only on my just a very small computer screen. So tonight I was in fact very excited. I thought, you know, because I thought it was rather entertaining in some ways. So I was very happy, and people did laugh at the absurdity of the story. So yeah.
Cheers.
And despite early hiccups, Cinema Reloaded continues, so if you feel like funding a young filmmaker and becoming a movie mogul yourself, check out their website, cinemareloaded.com. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the score to True Grit by regular Cohen collaborator Carter Burwell. Do pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday for my trailer trash column with the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.